Interesting. So there's a question about whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. I'll be darned. I didn't know that there was such a problem. but talk to us about this. Why the need to defend such an idea of the resurrection of Jesus? Any one of you guys?
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, of course, it's the cornerstone or foundation of Christianity because Jesus himself made it that way. He said, pretty much he made some passion predictions and predicted not only his violent and imminent death, but his subsequent vindication by God. So if he didn't do it, of course, he's a false prophet. Christianity should go down the drain, and all Christians, myself included, ought to just find something else to do, something else to believe. But if Jesus did rise from the dead, then that is something that requires, or at least calls for, a change in our worldview, for the Christian worldview. And that's the importance of the resurrection, and a lot of research has been done on it. It's a prime topic for interest. In fact, the deist New Testament scholar, Dale Allison, recently wrote that it is the prize puzzle of New Testament research. So it should be of no surprise to anyone that a ton of literature has been written over this, on this topic over the past three decades.
Well, how would you respond to the many people, many critics might say, well, look, I mean, and believers included would say, look, it's a faith issue. Why do we need to actually provide evidence for our beliefs?
Josh?
Well, you know, I don't, I wouldn't object to somebody, Christian or non-Christian, saying, you know, for me, this is an issue of faith. I don't want to debate it. I'll, you know, it's not my faith, or this is my faith. I mean, I think they can say those things. But I think the New Testament stance is quite different. I think the New Testament stance with several writers, I mean, everyone's bound to start with Paul, I guess, but he's not the only one, who says over and over again, what you do with the resurrection determines where you sit in your theology. And Paul said it's not a matter of faith alone. He said faith is vain if it can't be grounded. So I'm not going to call somebody silly or irrational if they say, hey, I'm fine, just believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who want to have a foundation, I think it's there, and I think that's a New Testament position.
Okay, well, what are some of the evidences that, first of all, I guess, let's talk about the idea or the fact, I guess you believe it's a fact, that Jesus Christ existed and that he resurrected from, So I guess we have two main, you know, big issues to discuss here. Who wants to take that, the actual evidence that Jesus was a historical figure?
Well, I'll go ahead and take a crack and I'll pass it over to Mike on the resurrection. But as far as Jesus as a historical figure, I think I would start by saying that if you want to look either at the New Testament or you want to look apart from the New Testament, either way. And let me make a comment about starting from the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that if you're going to be a skeptic or you're going to be a critic, you have to use something outside of the New Testament. But strangely enough, there is hardly a critic anywhere who will not cite New Testament passages, not think that we can get some value out of the New Testament, and they'll introduce rules. You know, when a text has satisfies this rule, that I'm more inclined to think it's authentic. And that's just the normal run-of-the-mill in scholarship. And if you allow New Testament passages, at least those that are evidence, to stand on their own, you're going to come up with a bunch of different authors, a bunch of different books, all which agree that Jesus lived. If you don't want to do it that way, or you want to supplement the New Testament, we can find 17 or 18 sources outside of the New Testament, all within 100, 150 years after Jesus, and they tell us anything from a half a sentence to a paragraph. Sometimes the authors tell us more than one thing, or they have more than one passage. And you put secular sources alone, not a Christian source among them,
mm-hmm.
you put those together, and you come up with about 48, 50 different comments about the life, death, even resurrection of Jesus and the early church, and never open the New Testament. If you want to throw a third category in there, Christian sources that are non-New Testament, you're going to pick up another couple dozen facts. So I think if you treat the historical Jesus the way you look at any ancient character, you find quite enough to say that he lived and that we can know a lot of things about him.
I guess if I could just add just one thing to that, the one thing you said about treating the New Testament, that no matter how skeptical you might be of it, there's things that you can get out of it. I mean, I don't believe anything about the Quran, that the Quran teaches. However, I wouldn't say that it's unsalvageable, as historically speaking,
mm-hmm.
I mean, because I can look at it and say, well, this is what Muslims were believing in the 7th century, or I can look at it and say, using historical method, I might be able to arrive at certain things that the historical Muhammad actually said, using certain criterion. So I can do that with the New Testament as well, things like the criterion of embarrassment and dissimilarity and things like that. Now, in terms of the resurrection of Jesus, of course, now Gary has coined what he refers to as the minimal facts, and those are facts that meet two criteria. They are strongly evidenced, and second, they have been persuasive or have convinced the majority of today's scholars, including skeptical ones, the vast majority of them, that these facts are true. So it doesn't mean that any particular conclusion, such as the resurrection, that is a minimal fact, because, well, of course, when you're talking about so many different worldviews, horizons involved, you're never going to come to consensus on that. But in terms of the facts, Gary has laid out 12 different facts and for the resurrection of Jesus. And we could probably boil all but two of those down to and combine them into maybe even three or four or five, such as Jesus' death by crucifixion, his empty tomb, and the beliefs of a number of people, friend and foe alike, in various settings, individual and groups, that he had risen from the dead, resurrected, and had appeared personally to them. So those will be the minimal facts, and I'd say that if we're going to talk about things seriously as historians, what we're going to have to do is to account for all of those facts and meet the criterion proper criterion for weighing hypotheses. And the hypothesis that meets and those criteria the best for accounting for those minimal facts is going to be the best explanation. And I guess the last thing I'd say in terms of these minimal facts, what's good about them is, you see, historians, we take the facts and we try to tie them together and create a narrative within our hypothesis. And what this does is it keeps us from running wild with our hypotheses, guided by our horizons or our worldviews.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you mentioned, so the best explanation, but not necessarily the absolutely correct answer, but just that it's one of the best explanations of a myriad of other worldviews.
Well, in history,
worldviews. Yes.
Any historian worth his salt will tell you,
right,
there is no such thing as absolute certainty.
Right.
And this is one of those rare things for which there is universal consensus. There is no absolute certainty. The best of professional historians who work outside of the community of biblical scholars will tell you that. They'll say there is no absolute certainty about any hypothesis. What we're looking at is what the best explanation is. And to the degree that a hypothesis best accounts for those facts, to the degree that it outdistances other hypotheses, shows that it's the best hypothesis, and its chances of being disconfirmed in the future become more and more unlikely.
Okay. Oh, by the way, Richard, feel free to step in anytime you want.
I just want to give them the chance to basically state their basic case. I mean, the main reason I'm interested in joining in is that I had some specific questions that were more probing to try and find out, try and understand why Gary and Mike believe what they do, and particularly addressing things that don't usually come up in debates. And so I want to let them make their case first and talk, and then when you're ready for some questions, I've got some good ones.
Okay, good. All right, then we can continue. So you mentioned, how does the Christian worldview then, Mike, I think this is for Mike, how does the Christian worldview then explain the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that we know it to be true?
Well, the Christian worldview, of course, says that the resurrection occurred because it is the cornerstone of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that it's true historically speaking. Gary and I just happen to think that there is extraordinary evidence, historical evidence for this, and a great case for it can be made to support the Christian view.
Okay, well, let's talk about it. So it sounds like it's kind of, well, is wrapped within it. It's a presupposition, really. I mean, once you accept it, that's just it. That's the central tenet. There's really no argument about it, really. But as I think Gary talked about earlier, but it's good to have that base, that foundation to defend your beliefs if necessary.
Could you clarify what you just said about the presupposition thing? Because I wouldn't want anybody to think that it's one of those things that, okay, you just believe it because that's mm-hmm. your religious belief. I mean, there are people like, well, there was the Jewish scholar Pincus Lapide, who did not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. He was not a Christian, but yet he still believed in the resurrection of Jesus.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, I guess we can move over to those evidences. We keep talking about evidences. We're talking, of course, just generalities. We're laying some groundwork here. So let's get into more specifics. Again, what are some of the actual historical evidences that Jesus Christ existed? And then, again, what are some of the specific things within the Christian worldview which allows us to actually accept that Jesus resurrected? Because, I mean, sure, it's in a book, but why even accept it? So two different aspects. So let's talk about evidences, and then why should we even accept it?
Well, I've already addressed the historicity of Jesus. Do you want me to say anything else about that in general? You want to?
Well, I thought you covered it in general already, but I thought maybe again specifically, maybe certain particular historians and whatnot, and how.
Let's stick with the resurrection.
Sure.
I think we should stay on that track and just.
That's a good point.
Assume the historicity of Jesus.
Okay, that's a very good point.
That's a whole other issue to debate that. Well, let's assume that and go from there.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll do. All right. Well, just you're right. Let's just stick to the resurrection.
Well, I think one of the keys. I think without any question, if you just look at the text that most people look at, friends, foes, and in between, the text that gets the most attention is 1 Corinthians 15, 3 and following. And if Mike talked about nearly unanimous, there are no such things as unanimous conclusions, but one of the most nearly unanimous conclusions in New Testament scholarship, actually this is seldom understood, but this did not come from the evangelical or conservative community at all. It actually came from the higher critical community and moved over to the conservatives. But about 100 years ago, there was some move to start realizing that the material Paul spends time on in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 and following, besides his actual words, where he says, I'm passing on to you what I also received, there are anywhere from 8 to 10 literary features here of this material that show that Paul is passing this on from an earlier time, like I said, beyond his own words. And most critics, I'll give you a quick rundown here, a quick timeline.
Sure.
Most New Testament scholars, this is nearly unanimous, 1 Corinthians is thought to be written about 55 A.D. And any difference from that, year here, 2 years here, doesn't have anything to do with whether you're conservative or liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Paul said he gave that teaching to them orally in the first two verses, and it is thought that he made his trip to Corinth about 51 A.D. So if we put the cross at approximately 30 A.D., that's about 20 years after the cross, 21 years after the cross, he came and preached this material. But most critical scholars who answer this question, not evangelicals, who answer this question, believe that Paul received this material probably in Jerusalem. Now, if you take the option that he received in Damascus, it's actually going to be earlier, but I take the later option. And I think that Paul probably received this material, or at least the facts on which the creedal material is based, that Paul received this material at about 5 years after the cross, 35 A.D. Now, the way they get that is this. In Galatians chapter 1, Jesus dies. His death is mentioned, rather. So let's call that 30 A.D. Put Paul's conversion at about 2 years after the cross, about plus two. Then Paul says in Galatians 1:18, he said, I didn't go running up to Jerusalem to check this out with everybody. I waited for about 3 years. And then I went up to Jerusalem, and I met with a couple of the apostles. Well, if he becomes a Christian at plus two years after the cross, or mm-hmm. 32-ish A.D., he goes up to Jerusalem 3 years later by his own timetable. There's no question about Galatians and 1 Corinthians as Pauline texts. You have his meeting with Peter and James approximately 35 A.D., and the key here is not the date, but the how long after the cross. So here's a report from about 35 A.D., and Paul talks to the witnesses, James, the brother of Jesus, and Peter. He goes back up several years later, asks the same question, are we all sure about this gospel? And there's James again, there's Peter again, and John is now there. This is in the early verses of Galatians 2. So critics will think, well, look, you've got the four biggest named early Christians. They're putting their heads together here. Once again, Paul, James, John, and Peter. And they agree on the gospel. Chapter 2, verse 6. Paul said, they did not add anything to me. Verse 9, we all totally agreed on this. They didn't find any reason to question me. So the gospel's the reason that this is, that this little get-together is, this conclave occurs. Now, as far as the date, I can just imagine somebody saying, well, that sounds like a pretty conservative date to me, 35 AD.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know that historians, whenever possible, especially ancient historians, whenever possible, want to, it'd be nice to have an eyewitness report. The few times we do have that, it'd be nice to have an early date. So 35 AD would be doubly important. But I'll just give you a couple examples of non-conservatives who make this move. Gerrit Ludemann, an atheistic New Testament scholar, puts the date for this material at 33 AD, or plus 3. The Jesus Seminar, not conservative at all, puts this, the date for this is pre-Pauline, before Paul's conversion. Paul got it later, but somebody else had it before him.
Mm-hmm.
That's plus 2. And just recently, James D.G. Dunn and others have, Gerald Collins, for example, have put the date of this at 30 A.D. So just to start, just to put something on the table, here we have the claims of an early report agreed to by eyewitnesses who were present at the events.
Okay, interesting. Sounds like some pretty hardcore evidences there.
Well, I mean, you know, like everybody else is saying, this doesn't prove anything. It proves what... What it proves is that we have early and good reports. Now, you can't just get in there and say, aha, resurrection. But you can get in there and have this data and say, what do we do with the report from the 30s AD? And what do we do with reports from people who claim to have seen the risen Jesus? I mean, when you're talking about Alexander, for example, Alexander the Great, probably our best-known biography of Alexander is not written for 400 years. Now, while we know there's issues with that, people don't step in and say, it's 400 years later, it's a bunch of bunk.
Mm-hmm.
In the ancient world, you have to do with sources that are 100 years old. Livy reports things that are much before his time. So does Tacitus. So does Suetonius.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty typical. But when you get something to plus 5, I think at the very least, that allows us to be placed on the table, and it says, this is serious. And that's, I think, what's going on here. You see a kind of a neon sign saying, you know, this is serious material.
I agree. I think it should, at least certainly for this show, for the purposes of this show, we should just assume that it was true in the sense that these people did see Jesus in some sense, in the way that 1 Corinthians 15 says, which is, it's very vague on the details. And of course, the common view is that this is, these were hallucinations or visions or dreams or something. And rather than get into that whole debate as to whether that was actually the case, I'd like to ask a sort of side question, sort of see where you are in the context of this whole debate, which has to do with, not with that particular vision, but or appearance, but other things that were going on in the church. And for example, in the book of Acts, the apostles are having vivid and powerful visions and dream communications from God all the time. We hear of similar experiences reported in that era from Jews and pagans, who are also having vivid and powerful visions and dream communications from a variety of different gods and angels. And so my question is how do you explain this? I mean, why isn't this happening now, today? And why was that happening back then, even to pagans and Jews who weren't seeing or hearing what the Christians were seeing and hearing?
Doc, I can jump in any time, but since you're my mentor,
yeah,
I'm going to defer to you on all
the
this.
Question. So, yeah.
Unless you want me to take something.
Well, go ahead, Mike. I don't want to be the only one speaking here, but Richard, if I understand your question, you're saying, A, why don't we see this today?
Right.
And B, what do we do with non-Christian accounts of visions and dreams and whatnot?
Yeah, exactly. And why was it so common back then across the spectrum of religions, but not today?
Let me make one comment on the second question, and then I'll let Mike jump in. I don't want to be the one dominating the discussion here. But, Richard, in New Testament scholarship, as you're probably aware, critics have actually been impressed of exactly the opposite. The book of Acts is a case in point. When New Testament writers discussed the resurrection appearances of Jesus, this was recognized by a German theologian named Theodor Keim in his three-volume Life of Jesus between 1867 and 1872 A.D. My point is, 135 years ago, Theodor Keim, a critic, was saying that one of the interesting things about the resurrection of Jesus is that in the New Testament, the resurrection appearances are delineated. They're separated from all the other visions, dreams. They are not said to be the same thing. Now, that doesn't prove either one is true or false. It just proves if Kime's comet is true in virtually all
right,
of...
Right, right. That's why, I mean, that enters into a whole other debate about the gospel and so forth. That's why I'm focusing just on what Paul says. Paul doesn't say the things that the gospels say specifically. I mean, he doesn't give us a narrative the way the gospels do. So in interpreting Paul, just at this point, and even that, I don't want to focus so much on what you think Paul meant when he said Jesus appeared, but I want to try and understand how it is that you explain the frequency of these visions and so forth. These Christians were constantly having communications from God, these powerful visions, in a way that doesn't happen to Christians today. And at the same time, the Christians weren't the only ones experiencing this phenomenon. The Jews and pagans were as well back then. And I'm just curious to understand how you make sense of this.